This week, Michael Cohen walked into a courthouse and told a federal judge under oath that he committed a felony and that Donald Trump directed him to do so. That happened within minutes of a jury convicting former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort on 8 felony counts. And then later this week, Trump chief financial officer Paul Weisselberg received immunity in exchange for his grand jury testimony. Does this spell the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic. I'm joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, who's a regular on this podcast.
Thank you for having me. What a crazy week. I mean, for people who love courtroom drama, this was some delicious legal news, wasn't it?
It literally reminded me of that last scene of The Godfather during the baptism where they're cutting between all these things happening at the same time. I imagine on television and these reporters were constantly cutting between. We have one courthouse where there's 8 felony counts coming down against Paul Manafort, and then in another courtroom in another city, 8 counts are being pled guilty to by Michael Cohen. Very dramatic, very big, but no news, in my opinion, was bigger than what Cohen said in federal court. And that was really a surprise. I wrote a piece in Politico magazine this week about how Trump was winning until Tuesday. He isn't winning anymore. And what I meant by that was, of course, the PR piece of this, and we'll talk about that later. But what I thought was interesting is if you look carefully at the charging documents for Michael Cohen.
I'll let you look at those because I'm not going to go through all that. That's a lot of information.
Well, you know, I was fair enough, and I don't think most people have. But as a former federal prosecutor, I spent time looking through these. And what's interesting about it is that when you look at the financial crimes, there's nothing in here that says that Michael Cohen was doing or committing those crimes at the direction of Donald Trump. There's nothing that says that Michael Cohen was consulting with Trump. Nothing about Trump's knowledge at all. Those documents were deliberately written to obscure that, to put that question off to the side. And out of nowhere, Michael Cohen says it anyway, under oath to the judge. And one interesting question that I've been talking to a lot of reporters behind the scenes is, why did Michael Cohen decide to do that? And I think the obvious answer is he wants to, at this point, take down Donald Trump.
Well, and why would they keep it deliberately out of the documents in the first place? They want to hold that off for something else. They're working on that investigation at the same time.
Well, let's try to think like federal prosecutors here. They're not radio hosts. They're not people on television. They're not trying to make a splash of the news. What they're trying to do is get from point A to point B without prejudicing anyone else.
Okay.
So they don't want to put, you know, that's why, you know, one question I got from people is, why did it say candidate when it's perfectly obvious when it says candidate one was elected president on this date? We know who he is. Why is that? Well, it's like that in every Department of Justice document, a charging document. And the idea is you don't want to name people unless you have to. You don't want to say more than you have to. So I think you had a lot of careful prosecutors in New York who were drafting this and saying, you know, what we're going to do is we don't need to say anything about what Trump knew or what he did. So let's just leave that out.
So as a former federal prosecutor, what would be your reaction when you'd been deliberate in the way you phrased that? And then the guy who's pleading guilty just throws that in there in front of the judge.
My first reaction would be to think about, is this accurate? Is this true? And if Michael Cohen was saying something to the judge under oath that I thought was false, that was contradicted by evidence, I would immediately pause the proceedings and have a sidebar conversation with Cohen and his lawyer. The fact that the prosecutors did not interrupt what Cohen said tells me that they did not have evidence that contradicted it.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't even thought of that part.
Yeah. So I think that it's very, very interesting. And, you know, the question now, I think, is what does that mean for the Trump presidency going forward and this campaign of a drumbeat of, you know, impeachment or collusion, all these things we've been hearing about, you know, for months. I talk about in that piece for months about how Trump has been talking no collusion, witch hunt, angry Democrats, and so on. And it's been working. There are a lot of people out there who are convinced that Mueller is doing something wrong. And what's really interesting here is these charges were not brought by Mueller. They're brought by a group of prosecutors in Manhattan. They have nothing to do with collusion. And I think what you saw this week was the Trump White House and the Trump team really struggling to come up with a counter narrative.
But was their prosecution an offshoot of what Mueller had uncovered or part of his investigation?
Well, he referred this over to New York, and there's been a lot of speculation as to why that is. You know, my take on it is, you know, one thing that we did see that I thought was interesting months ago was in the letters that were released that Trump's team wrote to Mueller, they talk about an agreement they have with Mueller that Mueller said he would not take on any additional lines of inquiry without notifying the Trump White House first, which is very unusual for a prosecutor. And it suggested to me that a lot of the attacks on Mueller and the integrity of the Justice Department by Trump were having an effect. He was being more conservative. And I think that from my perspective, that was part of what he was doing here by rolling this off to New York. Okay, you think my investigation's too sprawling, you think my budget's too high, you think I'm doing too much, fine. We'll let these people in New York investigate this piece of it. And it's much harder to attack the prosecutors there because they are part of a U.S. attorney's office that's been there, you know, 100 years or more, you know, more than over 100 mm-hmm. years. It's an institution. You can't not have federal prosecutors in New York. It's harder to imagine Trump saying we're going to shut that down.
But he still manages to get that message out there that he's the victim in all of this, that he is the victim of a witch hunt. And he seems to still be able to throw that in there, that there's no collusion, even though this has nothing to do with it in the Cohen situation.
Yeah, I think it's harder. It falls, the no collusion thing, I think, falls flat. I mean, the latest thing is it's no crime. I don't understand.
Oh, yes. I did see that, where they're like, it's not a crime to do that.
Well, it's kind of weird, right? So the idea that Michael Cohen would go into federal court and would plead guilty to something that is not a crime, that a federal judge would sit there and accept a guilty plea to something that's not a crime, Justice Department prosecutors would issue these charging documents and get a plea to something that's not a crime, and Cohen's lawyers, who are actually really competent, unlike President, you know, many of President Trump's lawyers, you know, the guy, Cohen's top lawyer, is a former chief in the Southern District of New York and in the Manhattan courthouse there, the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office there, he didn't object to any of that. Everyone agreed that in that courtroom, all the lawyers in that courtroom agreed that that was a crime. But somehow, some lawyer, there's a radio host or TV host who said it's not a crime for some reason.
Well, I think it was didn't Giuliani come out and say similar things? That
I think he did. And, what I would suggest is that tells you that you should not get your legal advice from Rudy Giuliani.
Well, and President Trump said, if you're going to get a lawyer, don't get Michael Cohen, even though he was one of only three of the clients Michael Cohen had for years.
Well, exactly right. Definitely a bad group of lawyers that have been representing Trump. So here, you know, here we have a bit of jujitsu that I think was offered by Cohen's statement, where literally, it kind of counterstepped or sidestepped the Trump's narratives. And now Trump is facing war on two fronts, so to speak. He's got now this group of prosecutors in New York who are advancing a federal investigation at the same time Mueller is acting. And I think, you know, the interesting thing now going forward is, you know, where does that federal investigation in New York go? And what part of what we saw later this week, of course, was Weisselberg. And it's funny, we're not even talking about Manafort, right?
Right. What happened to Manafort? It seems like something happened on Tuesday as well.
He got completely defeated. It was interesting. There was a reporting by CNN that the Trump team was gearing up to attack Mueller if there was a hung jury there. It didn't happen. You had eight convictions of Manafort. There's no way to spin that as a victory
And there's another trial coming up.
Right. Manafort is totally screwed. Yeah. I mean, he's waiting for a pardon, and you saw that the Trump team floated a pardon out there.
All right. And then comes the whole chain of what if we do this and you pardon this person? It gets a little bit mind numbing to think that they would even try something like that.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk. You're going to see people saying that that's obstruction of justice or witness tampering or so on and so forth. It's not something that Mueller is going to, and I say charge, I'm going to put that in quotes, air quotes, because he's generally going to be presenting things to Congress. But I don't even expect him to cite that.
Yeah.
But what I think it does show, in the ordinary sense of the word, it is Trump trying to throw a wrench at things and say to Manafort, don't flip, don't be a rat. I mean, we literally had the president of the United States talking like a criminal.
Right.
I mean, criminals, in my experience, talk about rats and get mad at cooperators and flipping. I will tell you, I had a former federal prosecutor reach out to me this morning and say, you know, you need to get out there that this is hurt, it can hurt us because we rely on, this is a current federal prosecutor said, we rely on cooperators. We rely on those for our cases. And that is so true. I mean, all a cooperator is somebody who comes forward to prosecutors and tells the truth about the criminals that they're working with.
At what level of information would somebody who is going to, you know, make a plea deal? What qualifies them to be somebody that is valuable to a prosecutor?
The prosecutor has to believe that what they're saying is the truth. They have to generally be able to corroborate that because they're going to get under attack. When cooperators are put on the stand in a trial, the judge instructs the jury to take their testimony with caution and great care. So, and we saw actually in the Gates testimony in the Manafort trial, you know, Gates had flipped and the jury, one of the jurors went on Fox News and said, we totally discounted everything Gates said.
We put
it off to the side and only considered the other evidence. You know, jurors are skeptical. So you have to believe what they're saying is true. Generally, you have to corroborate that testimony and they have to be moving the ball forward for you as a prosecutor. And that's why what happened with Weisselberg is interesting. So, you know, after all of this, I wrote this long piece in Politico magazine. I'm like, okay, we've had this new stage of the investigation. Now we can relax for the week. The CFO, the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, received immunity. And I will tell you that means something because prosecutors don't just give immunity out for free. You have to be getting something valuable in exchange.
How much information does a prosecutor try to get before they even begin to talk about immunity?
So before you give immunity to someone, if you're a prosecutor, you talk to their attorney and the attorney gives you what's called a proffer. It's essentially a summary of what the person's going to say or what the attorney expects the witness to say. And that gives the prosecutor a preview because prosecutors do not give immunity blind. In other words, they don't say, look, whatever you say, God bless you. You're not going to have, we're not going to hold that against you because you could say all sorts of lies under oath, et cetera. They want to know exactly what it is you're going to say before they are giving you immunity, typically. And that has to be of value to them.
Could it also be that the prosecutors already have evidence against that cooperator or that individual?
That very much could be. I mean, the request for immunity is going to come up in one of two ways. The way it'll typically come up is the defense, you know, the prosecution is going to go to the witness and say, we have this evidence, to use your example, we have this evidence that you may have committed a crime. We're willing to give you immunity if you testify. The other way could be the prosecutors approach this witness's lawyer and say, we'd like to have Mr. Weisselberg testify. And the lawyer says, well, I'm concerned about his liability for X and Y. And then there's a conversation between the witness's lawyer and the government about whether there's really liability there. And if the government's view is he doesn't really have any liability, they won't give immunity. They have to be convinced that there's actually some criminal liability there.
And what is the difference in the weight of the way you see it in the Mueller investigation and now the New York Attorney General?
Well, and that's a great segue because that was interesting reporting by the New York Times this week. The New York Attorney General's opened an investigation into these same transactions. So Weisselberg was given immunity to talk about these transactions with Michael Cohen, and you know, there's some interesting stuff in here. I'm gonna take a look at this. I'm looking now at the Michael Cohen charging document, okay? And it says that Michael Cohen, in seeking reimbursement for these election-related expenses, which is the hush money, he presented executives of the company, the Trump Organization, with a copy of a bank statement from the Essential Consultants bank account, which is that bank account the Stormy Daniels money came from, which reflected the $130,000 payment Cohen had made to, I believe that's Keith Davidson's bank account. And he adds in handwriting an additional $50,000, which represents a claim payment for tech services. And he summed that up to $180,000. Then the company, quote, grossed up, they put that in quotes, for tax purposes, Cohen's reimbursement of $180,000 to $360,000, then added a bonus of $60,000 so that Cohen would be paid $420,000 in monthly installments of $35,000 over the course of 12 months. And this is in the charging documents that were filed in federal court by federal prosecutors. Then it says that an executive of the company requested that this payment be made pursuant to a retainer agreement for services rendered, which is a falsehood. And Executive One, according to the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and NBC News, is Mr. Weisselberg, the CFO. So he makes this false statement, and he sends the invoice to another executive of the company to have it it says, please pay from the trust. The trust is the trust that Mr. Trump's companies, the president's companies, have been put into. And there's only two trustees, Mr. Weisselberg and Donald Trump Jr. And so it really appears to me that Executive Two is Donald Trump Jr. They're having this conversation about payment for these services rendered, which aren't really services rendered, a false statement. And what I think is interesting is Weisselberg has been asked about this under oath, presumably about this conversation with Donald Trump Jr., about this payment. And so we literally have him as a witness about Donald Trump Jr. We don't know what Donald Trump Jr.'s liability is yet, but you not only have the Manhattan federal prosecutors investigating what Donald Trump Jr. said and did here, but also now, as you point out, the New York Attorney General.
Is claiming ignorance enough of a defense in a situation like this when it comes to this transaction?
In fact, that is usually what the defense is. There's all these expenses. There's all this stuff out there. I have no idea. That's a typical defense. I will say, based solely on this, there's not enough. I will tell you this, a former prosecutor, there's not enough to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. The real question, which the Wall Street Journal was not able to confirm, is did the president know about these payments? What did he know? What's his potential criminal liability? Did he want these false statements to be made in financial records? If those false statements are transmitted to a bank in exchange for a loan, that's bank fraud, which is a federal crime. The New York Attorney General is looking at what I'll call lesser state offenses that are still felonies, but just for having false financial records, which is a crime in the state of New York.
And presumably, I would think that the person who knows whether or not President Trump knew what the money was for would be the person who has immunity now.
Mr. Weisselberg, and potentially it'll be interesting, Donald Trump Jr. One thing that we talked about jujitsu a little earlier here on the podcast. One interesting question is, if the New York Attorney General starts investigating Donald Trump Jr., we know they're investigating this matter. Donald Trump cannot pardon someone for state offenses. The president can only pardon for federal offenses. And I don't think Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, is going to be pardoning any Trump family anytime soon. So you could have Donald Trump Jr. facing unpardonable, effectively, charges. This is another sidestep of the narrative, something outside of the president's control, that Trump can't really shut down the New York AG. It's going to be harder for him to shut down what the federal prosecutors are doing in Manhattan. Suddenly he's facing war on multiple fronts.
Amazing.
I can think of really no one better to talk about this with than my friend Natasha Bertrand. Natasha is a reporter for The Atlantic. She is a contributor for NBC News and MSNBC. And she wrote a piece this week, you should check it out, in The Atlantic, about the New York Attorney General investigation and how that really is the most important front against Trump and all the implications of what that means about him. And Natasha and I have been following this investigation from the beginning, and she is one of the most important voices out there. Welcome to the show, Natasha. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we all read with interest your piece this week about the New York Attorney General's investigation. Why do you think that is so important?
Yeah, so I think that's something that's gone unexamined is the Trump Foundation. And that, of course, is what the Attorney General is looking at now. I think that we've looked a lot at the Trump Organization and the potential vulnerabilities there, especially with Cohen and his plea deal. But the common denominator between both the Trump Organization and the Trump Foundation, of course, is Alan Weisselberg, who we know was granted immunity to testify in the Cohen investigation. But I don't think that that's going to be the last that we hear from him. He was given immunity to testify, use immunity essentially, to testify before a grand jury with regard to the ongoing Cohen investigation in the Southern District of New York. But of course, both the president, Michael Cohen, the president's children, face significant legal vulnerability, potentially with regard to this the investigation that's being carried out by the New York Attorney General. And of course, that also would not be subject to presidential pardons, right? So if any kind of crimes arose out of that investigation, then the president would not be able to simply pardon, for example, his children if they were convicted of some kind of wrongdoing. So I think that that's definitely somewhere that we'll see Weisselberg's name pop up again. And of course, we also have the Manhattan District Attorney's Office looking at the Trump Organization. So there's a lot of legal headaches right now for the president.
Well, for sure. And, you know, one thing I was talking about earlier in the podcast is how the Cohen charging documents talk a lot about the Trump Organization and other people in the Trump Organization being in, you know, having knowledge of this and interacting with this. At the very least, a lot of these people are going to be witnesses and certainly under the crosshairs of the United States Attorney's Office in Manhattan, the federal prosecutors there. You know, what I think is interesting is we're starting to see elements of the legal battle against Trump that are really not under his control. You're talking about the New York AG, whether it's him or the New York Attorney General, or it's the federal prosecutors in New York, it's going to be hard for him to shut that down.
Right, absolutely. And I think that the Southern District of New York prosecutors really pose a more immediate threat to the president than even the special counsel. I wouldn't necessarily say they pose a bigger threat, but it does seem like they are bearing down on the president in a way that Mueller hasn't yet. And of course, the president has said in the past that his finances would be a red line. So I do wonder whether or not he will try to take some kind of action to stymie this investigation. But really, it is spiraling out of his control. And people on Capitol Hill, people who have traditionally been allies of the president, have said that this last week is a turning point. For the first time, they really seem to be acknowledging that this presents real legal peril for the president, because, of course, three of the people that have been closest to him throughout the last couple decades, really, David Peck, Alan Weisselberg, and Michael Cohen, are now cooperating with investigators, and that could be extremely problematic. People close to the president have acknowledged that. Even Steve Bannon said that this is going to potentially cost him and cost the party at the midterm elections. So this is definitely something that has the president brooding. He was not on his A game during his rally last week, and people noticed. And so I think that, you know, this is an area where he realizes that loyalty has always been a one-way street for him. And the people that he, you know, treated poorly throughout his time at the Trump Organization, when he was essentially the head of what people have liked to compare to this mafia family, he expected loyalty, but he did not always return that favor. And of course, now we see that Michael Cohen, who has been treated badly by the president pretty much from the time he started working for him, has really decided to just go all in and turn against the president and tell Mueller and prosecutors in Manhattan everything he knows.
That's for sure. He really, at this point, it seems to me that Cohen is eager, as I think the word I would use, to do whatever he can to cooperate. And I agree with you, Natasha, in terms of what we saw from Trump this week. You know, up until this week, we saw a very well-honed disinformation campaign coming from the Trump team, where witch hunt, no collusion, angry Democrats. There's always a new angle. This week, it was very hard. They had a lot of trouble responding. I mean, you saw on Fox and Friends, Trump was saying, "Well, I didn't see Cohen that much." I know Maggie Haberman said publicly that Trump would see Cohen every single day. You know, this is a guy who's recording his conversations at times with the president. It strikes me as it's harder. It's a harder narrative because it's not about collusion. It's not about Mueller. There's no dossier. None of that stuff matters. It's all the financial crimes out of Manhattan. Something totally different.
Totally. And I think that it's actually a lot easier for the public to understand. I mean, the Russia investigation has been kind of in the weeds. There have been a lot of incremental developments when it comes to this campaign person talking to this Russian, you know, the various connections between Trump's organization and, you know, Russian banks, for example. It's been all very complicated and difficult for the public to keep up with. You know, but when it comes to financial crimes, potentially, and things like tax fraud and, you know, really, you know, trying to defraud the government, not paying your taxes, filling out fraudulent bank loan applications, things like that, and campaign finance violations, it's really not that hard to understand. And I think that this is potentially very problematic, of course, for the president, because this is not about the Russian collusion investigation, and they've been trying to use that as kind of their saving grace. But this is arguably even worse, because it's actually something that the public can grasp onto and say, oh, well, you know, this, you know, there was money laundering going on, there was tax fraud, you know, these are things that are comprehensible, whereas there's kind of been a lack of imagination, I think, that's plagued both the public and even reporters, members of the press, regarding the Russia investigation. It's almost, the whole thing has almost been too difficult to comprehend. But Trump's real estate business and the financial, potential financial wrongdoing that he committed over the past, you know, 40, 50 years of his career, that is very easy to believe and very easy to understand. So I think that's where he faces a lot of problems if Mueller and prosecutors in New York decide to continue down that path.
Well, I will tell you, as someone who prosecuted and tried many financial crimes, jurors do not like people who get rich off the they don't, off of like cheating or fraud or anything. If you're getting if you're not paying your taxes and they're mad. If you're cheating, even if it's banks, I mean, no one really likes, a lot of the jurors don't like big banks, but they also don't like people who are cheating them out of money, because they don't get to cheat and they're not the ones feathering their nest. And so, you know, I think you were there from the Manafort trial. At least I saw a picture of you running out of the courthouse. So I know you were there. You know, what I saw really was a jury, and I thought it was amazing to listen to that juror, watch that juror on Fox News, who was a Trump supporter, very much wanted to believe Manafort, thought he was such a smart man and really liked him. And ultimately, she voted to convict on all of the counts because she was persuaded by the evidence. And I think, you know, on these issues, no matter where you're at, if somebody cheated and is either cheating other people out of their money or cheating the public, that's something people don't like.
Absolutely. And this juror, Paula Duncan, she's fascinating to me because she, I think, represents exactly what you and I were just discussing, which is, you know, the Russia investigation may be difficult, especially for Trump supporters, to understand or grasp or accept, you know, the idea that his campaign was in a conspiracy with the Russians to win the election. That may just seem, even for people who are critical of the president, that may seem like difficult to believe. I mean, even though there's a lot of evidence pointing to the fact that that is true. But you know, going back to Paul Duncan, there is a sense that she said, I did not want to go in there wanting to convict Manafort. I thought that this entire trial was the result of an illegitimate investigation to begin with. But when presented with the argument that prosecutors gave, which essentially boiled down to Manafort was a liar who didn't pay his taxes. You all have to pay your taxes. Manafort didn't. And when he did not have money, he lied to get more money. And he lived this extravagant, lavish lifestyle that he got used to. And all of that was at the expense of, you know, taxpayer dollars. All of that was at the expense of, you know, the United States government, which Trump supporters say, you know, America first. So faced with these contradictions, I think that the evidence was just overwhelming. And it was also not complicated, right? I mean, there was a lot of evidence. There were a lot of different, you know, there was a lot of talk of offshore companies and shell companies and, you know, banks in Cyprus, et cetera. But ultimately, it came down to a very simple fact, which is exactly what you said, is that when a jury is confronted with these facts, they really don't like people who got rich at other people's expense. And I think that ultimately could be the president's downfall.
Yeah, well, you know, I often, when I explain to clients now, because I'm on the other side of things, when I explain to clients about federal investigations, what I always tell them is the safest way to protect yourself from federal investigations and from federal prosecutors is never to get on their radar. Sort of like there's Russian hackers out there. I'm sure they can hack my computer, my phone, if they really wanted to. I'm sure they could just take me down, my little laptop, but they don't care. I'm not important enough to them. And you want to kind of stay out of the gaze. It's like the eye of Sauron in the Lord of the Rings. You want to stay out of the gaze, hide under a rock or something. And what the problem is now for President Trump is he is under the gaze of a lot of people. You know, the Attorney General's office in New York, the Southern District of New York, federal prosecutors, Mueller, And when prosecutors start looking through things, they're not going to look through everything willy-nilly. They're going to start from where they have evidence. But it's a potential problem if you've been engaged in criminal behavior. Paul Manafort and Donald Trump aren't the first people that have put themselves in that situation. It's actually a common thing. I mean, the fraudsters, people don't realize there's a lot of financial crime out there. There's a lot of fraud. And they're really, I'll say this from my experience, there's not nearly enough resources out there to catch even a fraction of the people who are committing those crimes. And often the people we would catch and that I would prosecute would be these people who are these moguls who had all these things going for them, but then would just keep putting themselves out there more and more and more. I think there just tends to be amongst people who commit fraud or financial crimes, they buy their own BS, mm-hmm. so to speak, and they just mm-hmm. become convinced of, you know, well, this is fine. I've always gotten away with it. And, you know, this is all good and fine. And then, you know, it starts tumbling down.
The hubris eats them up.
Exactly right.
Exactly. And also remember that Donald Trump has really never been held accountable for anything in his entire life, right? I mean, when he went bankrupt, Deutsche Bank bailed him out. When he committed adultery, when he had affairs, he just got married again. So, I mean, he's never actually had to face any real consequences for anything he's ever done. And I think the same goes for anything shady that he might have done in his real estate business, because, of course, real estate is not exactly the cleanest, most upstanding profession in the world. There's a lot of kind of corruption, mm-hmm. especially in 1980s and 90s Manhattan. So he's never had to deal with the reality, of this kind of attention, and B, with this kind of accountability that could come with him using or abusing his office of the presidency that he now faces. And that, of course, is something that's very new to him. And I think it's also why he's trying to operate outside of the system, and he still considers himself somewhat above the law.
I think, yeah, there's no doubt about that. It's interesting. I will tell you, I prosecuted real estate moguls myself here in Chicago, and the reaction I often got from their attorneys and witnesses was, well, this is happening all the time. There's a lot of people committing fraud, and, you know, I've explained to them there's a lot of people speeding on the interstate. That is not a good answer when you get called over by the police officer. Right?
And I have to know, though, what does it mean if they do find, you know, the kinds of crimes that we are suspecting might be there, especially since Weisselberg knows about every dime that's ever gone in and out of the Trump, you know, finances? Can he be indicted?
Well, okay, and I'll answer this, that the Justice Department has guidance that's been in place for many years that they don't believe a sitting president can be indicted. And essentially the logic there's nothing in the Constitution that talks about it. It's just that the logic is if the Constitution talks about impeachment and goes through a lot of detail there, then why do they do that if you could just indict the guy? That's essentially what that's okay. about. That's the view there. But because of that, Mueller would be presenting this to Congress. And I wrote about in that Politico piece this week, you know, if you have 34 Republican senators who will never vote to convict, Trump can get away with a lot. But that's why what Natasha talked about in that piece is so important. You know, she pointed out not pardonable. You cannot, you know, Trump cannot pardon New York State offenses. And so who knows what could come from that.
Okay.
Well, Natasha, what do you see coming ahead, and what should people expect in the weeks to come?
Well, of course, we're going to watch and wait and see whether or not Manafort actually decides to go through with the second trial that he's facing in Washington on charges of, you know, acting as an unregistered foreign agent of Ukraine. That trial is set to start on September 17th, but there are serious questions about whether or not he will actually go to trial, because, of course, now he knows that a jury is willing to convict him. His blind confidence going into the first trial did not serve him well, so we'll see. The other question, of course, is whether or not the president is going to pardon Manafort. As I wrote in another piece this week, there are a lot of forces acting against that. For example, Trump's legal team, which he, of course, is not known to listen to, but his legal team is really warning him against pardoning Manafort before the Mueller investigation ends, which, on the other hand, this also could be tantamount to kind of dangling a pardon and obstruction of justice and witness tampering. Mm-hmm. But so that's something to look out for. If he does pardon Manafort against the advice of his attorneys, I suspect it would be after the election. I suspect that anything kind of momentous would take place after the midterms. But these continued attacks on his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, are something also to look out for. Again, you know, Lindsey Graham and other Republicans on Capitol Hill have intimated that, you know, they they expect that that Jeff Sessions could be replaced, and that it is the president's right to have an attorney general that he has confidence in. So they're kind of, they seem to be laying the groundwork that there could be a significant shift there. And, of course, we have to keep an eye out for developments on whether or not Trump is going to sit down with Mueller to have that interview that he's been so reluctant to have, in which Rudy Giuliani has just been pushing back and pushing back over the last few months, even as he tells Mueller to wrap it up. Mueller, of course, is reportedly writing a report on the president committing obstruction of justice. It's not clear whether or not he can finish that report before he sits down with the president. But whether or not Trump actually decides to sit down with him and face him and face the questions he has about potential conspiracy with Russia and also about, firing Jim Comey, attempting to replace Jeff Sessions last year, his outburst over Sessions recusing himself from the Russia investigation. That is also something to keep an eye out for.
Absolutely. I will say I'm not holding my breath for Donald Trump sitting to answer questions, but that's going to be that whole jousting back and forth over that interview is going to be interesting. Thank you so much for joining us, Natasha.
Thank you.
I really appreciate
it.
Such great insight. Thank you.
And thank you to all of you for joining us on our first episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and go to our website for more information. And of course, join us next week for the next episode of the podcast. Until next time, let's stay on topic.